Now entering Nerdist.com.
It's time for another episode of Big Pop Fun with Tom Wilson. Join Tom as he talks to the artists, writers, performers, and personalities that affect that he can talk into you on the show. Here's Tom.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Big Pop Fun Podcast with Tom Wilson. I am Tom Wilson. You are lovely, yet larger than you had imagined when you meet me in person, host. And let's go on a magical sleigh ride of wonder and excitement and fizzing things that fizzies, those, the drink things, you won't ever remember that, but it was a thing where you dropped tablets. It was like an Alka-Seltzer, but it tasted like that. You know that grape drink? No, not grape aid, not grape juice, I mean grape drink that came in a plastic jug, and it was kind of like a purple battery acid kind of a thing. Well, if that wasn't enough to buy that and drink grape drink in the summertime, you could get fizzies, which were Alka-Seltzer tablet-like fizzy flavorful things that could actually produce almost the delicious flavor of grape drink. But I don't know where I got on off that tangent. Hey, welcome to another podcast. Thanks so much for joining me today. It's my pleasure. I'm going to try to make this brief because I talked to my friend Mike for quite a while and we had a lot of fun, and I hope you enjoy it. Thanks for enjoying the previous podcasts. Thanks for emailing. Thanks for the postcards. The story that I got from Juan Luis at blog.juanluis.com. Thank you, Juan, from across. Yeah, this is from England. And just tell him, you know what was impressive to me about getting a few postcards and a few letters, not very many, but it's that people feel compelled to tell me a little story of their day. A little, Juan Luis sent me a postcard, which is about lost consonants, and William Shakespeare is cooking in Japanese cookware, and it says, "The Collected Walks of William Shakespeare." So thank you, Juan Luis. But the noteworthy thing on the card, on the postcard, or as we would say in Philadelphia, postcard, was just his telling me the story of being in a park and watching a little girl running around the park with a mother cheering her on. And he didn't realize for a while that the girl was actually racing and running laps for a joyous mother who was, I suppose, timing her or whatever. But it was just a little slice of his day that he felt like sharing with me. So thanks, Juan Luis. But I think it was only noteworthy to me because I guess it means that you guys are responding to me sharing some of my days and some of the things that have happened to me. The impressive thing about this podcasting world, which I'm new to, I still freely admit I don't know what I'm doing. But the interesting part of it to me is that with every technology, with everything that's happening, this quote-unquote connectivity that is actually quote-unquote distancing ourselves from one another, within podcasting, with the intimacy of earbuds, we're kind of just saying, hey, look at this. I'm another human being, just like you. That's what I'm trying to do on this podcast, is just talk to interesting people, people that I find interesting, friends of mine, as you've heard, most people I know, because I find their lives or stories interesting. They're authentic. They've come to mostly the arts, yes, but they've come to the arts from different directions, and they've ended up here. How does that happen? And as I've already told a few guests, boy, I think I'm going to be in trouble in a while, because if there's one thing I don't think I'm good at, in fact, I know I'm not good at, it's mustering interest in something I'm not interested in. I don't think I would be a good morning TV show host. I don't think I could do it. You know, Good Morning Cleveland. Well, Bob, tell us more about your trip and doing your new TV show. I don't really think that's my thing. But, you know, but I can certainly tell you about my new TV show or movies and stuff, I guess. I'm back from Boston again. I know I already told you I'm back from Boston. I'm back from Boston again. I had to go back and finish up my work on, I think it's got a tentative title. It's called The Heat. Sandra Bullock, Melissa McCarthy, myself in a very, you know, huge role. Don't blink. But we had a lot of fun there. I was staying on the water in the lovely Fairmont Hotel, which I think I told you about previously. But it's a hotel with, I'm in a movie and stuff, and they take you there and you're traveling and they're sending cars to pick you up. But I'm opening the room service menu and, you know, that $28 club sandwich menu. Anyway, I spent all of my time in Boston walking three blocks to 7-Eleven to get a 7-Eleven sandwich because I was near nothing else. I wasn't near anywhere. So I had a lot of 7-Eleven sandwiches because I knew, you know, they even give you money to buy food and everything. But I just, that, you know, you sign a couple of those room service things on $52. You know, the Coke only comes in those 8-ounce tiny bottles. So so I did a lot of 7-Eleven eating. So thank you, 7-Eleven and Southland Corporation, for taking care of my questionable nutritional needs in Boston. And of course, as I always thank 7-Eleven for back in 1994 during the big earthquake in California, when immediately in one day, suddenly water costs $30 a gallon. Thanks so much, 7-Eleven, for the caring, really, because you really do. You know who's a wonderful person is Jane Curtin. Jane Curtin, the actress from Third Rock from the Sun, from the original cast of Saturday Night Live. She's in this movie, and she was just delightful. What a very nice and down-to-earth lady who lives in Connecticut now, and just joyful to spend time with her. Bill Burr, wonderful, talented comedian with his own very, I mean, bigger, way bigger podcast than mine. Check out his podcast if you like. We had fun with Bill and a bunch of people in Boston who all apparently pirates with tattoos have taken over Boston because they're everywhere. But in a Boston tattoo really is, you know, you can have a snake going all the way down your arm from your neck and everything. But at the end, when its head is at your hand, it has to have a shamrock in its mouth. Every tattoo revolves around shamrocks. I think a Greek fishing boat would actually somehow run aground anywhere near Boston, and the first thing those guys would have to do is go out and get shamrock tattoos. But that was Boston. A lot of Irish there, a lot of Italians there. I was on the North End. I actually went to the Maria della Cava Italian Festival on the North End of Boston. It was delightful. If you've seen The Godfather Part II, they have one of those Italian street festivals where you run up and staple gun a dollar bill to a statue of Mary and then, you know, and then go and kill a major mafia figure if you're Vito Corleone. But in this case, we just staple gunned dollar bills to the Blessed Mother statue, and I ate some pasta off a plastic plate, and it was kind of a ridiculous scene because I was alone. I was alone and I was walking through the North End, and I end up in the Maria della Cava Italian Festival with, you know, with Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin playing. Boy, those guys have really become the theme song of the Italian American neighborhoods now, huh? I mean, really, it's 2012, but when the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's every festival now. You're just, wow, it's still that's amore. So I had the pasta on a plastic plate with a plastic fork, and I'm alone. I'm not sitting in one of these tables because the big Italian guys with the snake, with the shamrock thing, they're sitting at the tables, and I'm sitting there under the blazing Boston sun and thinking, I'm just standing here, the big Irish guy in Boston with no shamrock tattoo and a plate of pasta with a lot of big, thick-neck guys looking at me like, what's he doing here? Hey. So I moved on. But you know what the delightful end of the Maria della Cava Festival was on the North End of Boston? Italian ice. How can you not have that? And I will always translate to Philadelphia, and for my Philadelphia friends, water ice. I had a water ice, a cherry. There was a cart, Italian ice cart. I had a water ice, at the end of my, you know, questionable pasta with the guys with tattoos, I had a delightful cherry water ice. And to the strains of Frank Sinatra singing Summer Wind, I crossed the street and went out to the water again. And cherry water ice in hand, I looked at the boats as the sun set on Boston Harbor there. And that was really good. So my time with Sandra Bullock, fabulous, A+. Melissa McCarthy, A+. Jane Curtin, A+. Bill Burr, A+. People, cherry water ice, off the chart. I had fun. You know, I've been an artist for a long time now, but it's absolutely through plodding. I am a plodding artist, pulling my plow through the dry ground of my lack of talent, but I love it. I love art. I love museums. I always have. My dad took me to the Philadelphia Museum of Art when I was a kid, and I just love museums. I love the cool marble under your feet. I love the hushed tones. I love how when you're talking in low tones to your friend that your voice is bouncing off the marble walls. I like the coming around a corner and way down the hallway they've designed it like a they've designed it for the visual impact. There's some gigantic dramatic painting that's now 50 yards away from you, but you turn a corner going up a grand staircase and you go, oh my gosh, look at that thing. So I love the Philadelphia Museum of Art, but I was a kid. No, I didn't like Corot landscapes or the very sophisticated John Singer Sargent portraits of women in the 1800s. There was this gigantic painting there of, you know, a muscly guy. He was in a loincloth and he was like in the air or something, and an eagle was ripping at his shoulder. This gigantic eagle had come down and hit, and he was bleeding and blood, and he was this muscle guy, looked like an athlete. I don't know. You know, it was basically, I guess, a 16th century version of Rambo. But I loved looking at that thing. It was so cool. Look at how that eagle's ripping the guy's shoulder apart. You know, so I like those kinds of paintings because I was a kid. But I did love museums and I loved art. And I always have had respect for it and love for it, though I had no talent for it. I began really ploddingly study art and study painting. A lot because of my friend Mike Bayouth, who's a great artist, just so gifted at drawing, but he's gone far beyond that into advertising, graphic design, storyboarding on movies, directing movies, into performing, writing on the Dave Thomas Show with SCTV people. Anyway, Mike is a great guy. We're old friends, and boy, wait till a couple of these stories.
It's Big Pop Fun.
Up here.
But we have to begin, I guess, by talking about your dad, don't we? Or do we?
I mean, that's where most people begin.
And that's where, you know, we were friends and everything, but I was most incredulous when I heard that Ted was your dad. Because I knew both your dad and you separately from each other.
Yes.
I knew your dad in the movies. I knew you from our relationship at the Comedy Store and everything. And then when the two were met... Oh, that's my dad. It was like, I mean, I was freeform through space at the incredulity of how this man would have this son. Not that you're exact opposites, but you have to admit it's incongruous.
It is incongruous.
That you were an artist.
Most kids, you know, want to be just like their father. They want to grow up to be just like daddy. And not only did my dad enjoy... You know, playing characters like Jason Voorhees in Friday the 13th.
Right.
But he wore the mask around on the set during breaks. He loved being Jason Voorhees.
But your dad, I must say, you know, he's, I guess, just that image of the roughest, toughest stuntman, actor figure that you could imagine in Hollywood. And even in, I suppose, I met your dad. How old's your dad now?
He's 86.
86 and doing well? Healthy?
He's doing really well.
He was doing stunts. Well, he did stunts in the first Back to the Future movie. I think that's where I met him.
Yeah.
He, Marty, on the skateboard, Marty actually runs into him. He's an older man with an older lady in the courthouse square. And Marty just bashes into him with the skateboard. And I think the lady falls over or something. So, Ted White. And Ted, and everyone's, oh, Ted, they're talking to me about Ted. The stunt, Walter Scott, the stunt coordinator, is talking about Ted coming on. Oh, Ted's worked with everybody. Ted was on John Wayne movies and everything. And and Ted's a terrific guy, but was quite a macho stuntman figure.
I mean, he has stories that are a mile long that precede him. He is known throughout the industry as being one of the toughest, most knowledgeable men on and off screen.
Your dad is in Against All Odds, playing the security guard in Against All Odds.
Oh my
the security guard of the building.
That was
Swoozy Kurtz. There's a guard dog a Doberman Pinscher that is growling at Swoozy Kurtz.
And you can hear the dog's mouth going.
Yeah, and Swoozy Kurtz says, like, your dog is making me nervous. And your dad, in one of those perfect Hollywood lines, just looks at her and says, he should make you nervous.
That's right.
With this look of death in his eyes.
He's supposed to bother people.
Yeah, that's right, right. He's supposed to bother people. I mean, it's just... So this figure that I meet on movies and everything, stuntman, and he's just rough and tough, and he can do cowboy stuff, and you could just bash into him with a car. I'm fine. Get away from me. And then you and I are friends at the Comedy Store. You're coming over. You're an artist and a young performer and everything. And you say at one point, my dad's an actor and a stuntman. He works in the... Oh, really? Have I worked with him? Yeah, my dad's Ted White. Ted, what? What? Ted White. So how does it happen?
Well, it's kind of a dysfunctional, crazy childhood, you know? Like I said, he wore the mask around a lot, even when I was a kid. You know,
but that was the 70s, though, wasn't it?
That was the 70s, but he was just he was in character, whether he was at home. He was this big, tough guy, and I was just this nice little kid who was conscientious and sweet, and he'd just look at me with his head go, oh, where did I fail you, you know? Where did I fail you?
He couldn't have done that.
But it was like, you know, I just was the antithesis of him.
You were. Was that natural? I mean, what happened in your life? So Ted, Dad's coming home, and he is an actor and a stuntman. So he's coming home, with like fake blood on his head?
We'd hear the front door go, and we know he's home, and we're in the living room or the family room, maybe 20 feet away from the front door. Now, about 15 minutes later, he actually makes it into that room because he's walking so slow.
Oh, because he's just so the years of injuries and everything.
Like, and you hear this. And it's like my brother and I looking at each other going, wow, this must have been a bad day. And he finally comes through the door frame, and which is not quite big enough to house him.
Yeah, because he's a big guy.
And what happened? They set me on fire, and I fell off the top of the roof 4 times.
because that's what he would do. You get a Chips episode, and you're making your money and everything, but today, Ted, we're going to have 3 motorcycles run over you, and then a biker comes up and kicks you in the head.
Okay, where do you want me to lay down? Yeah. And so I, of course, my brother and I said, oh, this is the best. Oh, where do we sign up?
So when you were a kid, you wanted to be a stuntman?
Yes. And his conversation was, you know what? There is no conversation. We're not even having this conversation. You're not going to become stuntman and figure out something else. End of story. And he'd get up and walk away.
Because, I mean, how did Dad – I would love to talk to Dad on the podcast sometime. How did – that happened for him? Was he, you know, he was born here in Southern California, or what happened?
He saw too many of his buddies' children get involved and get killed.
Oh.
And it's when a family member dies from an accident or a producer that wants to do a retake and it's not reset properly.
Sure.
My dad is all about safety.
Yeah.
You talk to anyone.
Well, and you and I know. I mean, I know stuntmen who've died. I mean, there are – it's very – very dangerous, and people are very badly injured and die doing stunts. So I know certainly my son, my kids are not going to be stunt people.
Safety is no accident. You called me from the set of Back to the Future, when you were down in New Mexico or wherever riding a horse with a 60-pound sack being pulled behind the saddle, you know.
Trying
to emulate the weight of Michael J. Fox, and you were afraid that it was going to pull you off the saddle.
Oh, my gosh.
They wanted that horse in a full run.
Full gallop.
And you're not a stuntman. You're going, Mike, I'm afraid for my life. And I was like feeling your
pain.
Well,
you just know when you're doing a stunt like that, like so many, most of the time it's something that will take a technical skill that you have that the stuntman tries to teach you how to do. Here's how to fall. Here's how to approach that. Here's how to take that punch. Then there are a few when the stuntmen are coming up to you and you could see by their face that, like, I'm not crazy about this one. You know, yeah. For Tom to do.
Right.
So they begin like, all right, look, Tom. You're just like, oh, no. What? He's not that confident about this. No, when the horse starts again, be careful. Now, hang on to the thing. Well, we can't have a stunt guy do that. We're paying somebody to be here for me, right? Well, the camera's going to be really close. So just now.
And just in case, we've loaded in 40,000 pounds of sand from the local nursery.
Right. Now look over there, Tom. We do have ambulances ready.
Great.
Now,
that's
turn on the lights of the ambulances, fellas, so Tom can see. See, now everything's going to be just fine. But how did Dad become a stuntman? Was it just desperation and moving to California, or was he born here?
Andy Griffith gave him a shot on an old movie called Onion Head. He was like they needed a bunch of extras to be in the ocean, and there was a lot of sharks around. And so he met Andy Griffith through doing this little extra work in the ocean around these sharks. And then about a year later, he said, hey, remember that guy Ted White? Let's get him. He was doing the Andy Griffith Show. And my dad played Avery Noonan, who was like an escaped convict. And he had two lines of dialogue, and he has a piece of wood, a hickory, and a stick in his hand. He says, Barney Fife. And he's something about Barney Fife. And Tim and Don Knotts are about ready to get into it. And Andy Griffith drops a sack of flour on his head. So that was his big, like, foray into stunt world. And mm-hmm. He met John Wayne shortly after that. He was a consultant on Sands of Iwo Jima. And then he actually started doubling John Wayne in Horse Soldiers and Rio Bravo and the Alamo and Hatari. And he just went on from one
Dad worked with John Wayne. Now, you have to tell the John Wayne. But we'll get off Dad soon. But you got to tell the John Wayne story because it's just so – classic Ted White.
And it's classic John Wayne.
And it's classic John Wayne.
Because John Wayne had no small ego.
Yeah.
And my dad, pretty close behind. So yeah. Both of them
– Yeah. And John Wayne was called the Duke by everybody. People called him Duke.
Right.
And just because maybe – he was thinking about them calling him king,
right.
But maybe that would be too much.
And some actors are okay with, somebody being on the set that outshines them. When my brother was doing Star, my dad was doing Starman, he was out in Kentucky somewhere, and Jeff Bridges found out that all these people had come from out of town and were lining up in the streets. And he goes, oh, this is great. You know, I didn't realize I was such a celebrity out here in Kentucky or Louisiana, wherever they were. And they found out that Jason was on the set, my dad, who had played Jason, and they were out there to see. But Bridges was like, that's hysterical. He took it great. Now, move to 6, 7, 10 years prior, my dad's in Nairobi filming Hatari with John Wayne, and they've got like a compound. It's a little city, but it's all a makeshift compound out in the middle of Africa.
Where they're literally staying.
Staying.
Because, those early, I know the early Westerns, those John Ford things, they were going out and camping in the desert to make those like Rio Bravo.
Yes.
Like literally fires by tents.
That's right.
And they would wake up from their tent and then go make the movie because there was not a Motel 6.
No.
There was nothing.
They were living there.
So really, and later on in Nairobi, doing Hatari,
mm-hmm.
and they're living in the same way, in a tented compound.
So my dad is practicing roping animals, and he's got a lot of roping to do in this movie to double John Wayne. And he's roping a stump out in the middle of this compound, and it's like a full city with people and mothers and children and babies, and this mother happens to be pushing a stroller across the compound with a baby in it. And just at that moment, one of the makeshift cages that they had made to house some of these animals within the compound with a Cape buffalo in it. Now, I don't know if you know anything about a Cape buffalo.
A Cape buffalo is one of the largest and most dangerous mammals on Earth.
The key word being dangerous.
Dangerous. Incredibly dangerous.
It breaks out of its cage. And here we are, a baby in a baby stroller. This, like, the mother, and they're just both caught, in, like, deer in the headlights.
It
just
couldn't be more perfect.
Frozen in time. And there's my dad. With a rope. Well, I'll just rope that Cape buffalo. And
so Ted really runs after the Cape buffalo.
And ropes it and then ties off the rope around the stump he was roping and saves the woman and her baby's life. So now, big hero in the compound.
Of course, in Nairobi, this is still talked about.
The Nairobi press come out and they're the right. And so, story comes out in the local Nairobi rag. I don't know what it was called, but it got around the set.
So, Nairobi Times, stuntman on Hatari.
Right.
Ropes, captures Cape buffalo, ropes the legs, ties to a stump, saves a woman with a baby.
Right.
So our hero.
So now cut to the next day.
John Wayne.
After the paper had come out, John Wayne was already a couple of sheets to the wind at the local watering hole with a couple of other stunt guys.
Yeah.
And my dad comes in, same watering hole, and he sits down at the other end of the bar and orders up his favorite drink. And so he's sitting there having a few shots, and he hears down the bar from John Wayne, "Well, there's the cowboy that got his name in the paper." My dad didn't say anything, and Duke said under his breath, "For 2 cents, I'd kick your ass." And my dad just grabbed a handful of change that was on the bar and threw it down at Duke and said, "That ought to cover it," and they both went for each other. And the guys in between them stopped them, and they were, I mean, two big 6'4" men.
Yeah.
It was a lot to stop.
Yo, yeah.
And so that was the last film of my dad ever did with Duke.
And he was after that, that was the last one with John Wayne.
That was the last John Wayne film.
But, I mean, dude, your dad roped a Cape buffalo and then the next day got in a fist fight with John Wayne. I'm sorry. Your dad is the coolest guy in the history of humanity.
And he knows how to have fun. In the other side of being cool, he knows how to have fun. He played some practical jokes on Fess Parker.
Daniel Boone.
Yeah, stuff, yeah. He was Fess Parker's stunt double for 7 years on the Daniel Boone Show. And they went to British Columbia with Fred Bear. And Fess was going to get his grizzly bear. And Fess said to my dad, "Can you come along? I want you to be my bodyguard." And Fess said, and my dad said, "Okay, yeah, I'll come, you know." And they all went on this grizzly bear hunt.
Oh, this was for hunting a grizzly bear.
This is for hunting a grizzly bear now in British Columbia.
Yes.
But my dad,
tell me Dad ran through. Dad, before he wrestled the bear, he actually took off his shirt this time. Tom actually took off his shirt and put a knife in his teeth before he ran through the forest to save Fess Parker.
Him and Fess had running jokes. They would tease each other because they knew each other so well. So practical jokes was really the name of the game. So back in the, you know, when you're camping out in British Columbia and you're all just camped out, you have to be safe. And if somebody's going to go do their business, you just carry a little TP in your pocket and you go do your business. And after dinner one night, Fess said, "Well, I got to go show Grandma's who's boss and I'll be back in a few minutes." And he goes out to the jungle to do his thing. And my dad grabs his camera, his 35 millimeter with a motor drive on it. And he heads around the other side and hides in the bushes. So he's right on the other side. And Fess is, God rest his soul, is doing his business. And my dad starts growling, just like maybe 10 feet away. He can't be seen because it's thick bushes. Fess turns white and trips, and he's trying to get his pants up, and my dad's camera is going, just getting all of these horrible, uncompromising shots that you can may well imagine just horribly messy and awful. Uh-huh. But anyway, my dad made it back to the camp in time. He had his feet up, hit the camera, and Fess comes running back in. "Oh, my God, I almost got eaten by a grizzly." "Really? What happened?" You know, and so didn't say anything more about it. They got the grizzly. The show was a big success. But after they went back to the sound stages at Fox, My dad was making 8x10 glossies and putting them up in his dressing room. So Bess would walk into his dressing room and you hear this, "Oh my God!" For months, he said,
a new brand new shot.
Oh no! You hear this rip, rip, shred, shred. But yeah, no, my dad had fun, and he, you know, he also, when he was finishing up his stint in Africa, Howard Hawks, the director, said, "Ted, did you have a good time? Did you get everything you wanted?" Back in those days, it was very PC to be able to hunt and get the big five, and you know, they hunted elephant, and there wasn't an issue about hunting back then like there is now, which animals are like that are extinct now. But my dad said to Howard Hawks, he goes, "You know what I really wanted? I wanted to come back and get a tiger." And he says, "Really?" And
this is Howard Hawks, famous director.
Yes. So Howard Hawks said, "Wait there." Howard Hawks comes back and hands my dad an envelope. My dad looks at it, and it's a 2-week trip to India to go on a tiger hunt. My dad says, "Oh my gosh, I don't know what to say." And he says, "That's a thank you from us to you for all your hard work, and enjoy yourself." So my dad diverts his trip from Rome to India and flies to India. Now there's this little town in I forget what part of India, but this tiger has been plaguing this small town. Children have been, 200 people have been taken by this tiger. Old people, young children. And so they get my dad and a couple of white hunters and kind of a hunting party, and they go in for 2 weeks hunting this tiger.
For 2 weeks, they go into the jungle in India.
Yeah, into the jungles of India. And sure enough, they found the thing up on this ridge, ready to pounce on him. And my dad squeezed off a shot and got this thing, and they sent him the entire tiger skin rug a month later that, as kids, like my brother and I growing up with a full-size tiger skin rug in your house.
With a huge head and everything, one of those things.
With a huge head and the teeth and everything.
Was in your house?
It was in our house.
Where was it in your house?
Well, it was on a rug in the living room.
So the rug in your living room was a full-sized tiger with its head, with the bared teeth and everything.
We'd get up in the middle of the night, and we'd walk into the living room and see this. The moonlight would be hitting it. And then once we got used to it, of course, we'd sneak underneath it and scare each other.
Sure,
And that that lent for a lot of good comedic scares.
Man, oh, man. So was it... did you ever want to be a stuntman, or did you just figure, hey, look, Dad doesn't want it, and I don't want to get in the movies in that way? I mean, I guess my question is, like, when did you recognize, wow, my interests and my skill set is far different than Dad's?
Well, my mom was an artist, and so...
Oh, your mom was.
I kind of got the whole art thing from my mom.
Oh.
She used to be a fashion illustrator for Gimbel's Department Store.
Oh, sure.
So I really was... just taken away by the whole art thing, and I went to night school. I got into a job at NBC right out of high school.
So at high school, what were you doing? I mean, I love that your dad coming home with the dried blood and a tiger over his shoulder, and you saying, "Dad, could I have some money for oil pastels?"
Where have I failed you?
Just color pencils is my thing. That's what I want for Christmas.
I couldn't even open up the conversation about becoming a stuntman because he wouldn't even tolerate the He wouldn't even tolerate the conversation.
And in high school, when you were drawing things and you had that proclivity, you had a talent for it. You were the guy in high school that was just drawing some things and
absolutely.
I just could do the stuff.
Right 2 weeks after I graduated Taft High, I was working in the NBC graphic arts department.
Really?
Yes.
And what kind of things, when you get a job in the graphic arts department, at that time, I suppose, at NBC, what were you doing?
Well, there was no computer, so you did everything by hand. And if there was a graphics for a news program or for any of the programs, The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson, I did all of their the More to Come graphics in between the commercials.
I remember people who remember The Tonight Show, yes, in the commercial break, a piece of art would come up.
Yeah.
That was a stylized Hollywood scene or a landscape, something
more
that was
to come.
Southern California. And it would say More to Come or Be Right Back or whatever.
Right.
And so you did those kind of – is that a painting that you would do?
A lot of them were were paintings. A lot of them were illustrations. They were just all.
And what's the difference between an illustration and a painting, just for people listening?
A painting is something you do primarily with a brush and paints, and it's all done with a brush, a wide brush. Those are considered paintings. When you do illustration, you're getting into rendering. You're using things called an airbrush. You're getting into charcoal and pencil and detailed rendering, and it's an amalgam of media.
Yeah, it's a very specific drawing,
right,
in a sense, with the colors on there.
That's
but
right.
That would be a very, like one of you, I remember a really nice, you did a Jack Nicholson, didn't you?
Yes.
Years ago that I don't see up here.
Yes.
But it was a very sharp rendering of Jack Nicholson, which would be considered an illustration.
Absolutely.
And not a painting.
An amalgam of Prismacolor pencil, airbrush, paint. So that becomes a multimedia illustration.
Yeah, but far more specific than that loose, well, we call it loose, than a painting would be.
Right.
Which is kind of that sort of impressionistic, not realistic view,
yeah,
of the guy.
Paintings, yeah, can go very abstract and go into an impressionistic area. And paintings are very obvious because they obviously have been executed with a brush.
So right out of high school, how do you get that job? You just show them drawings that you did in high school?
I had drawn this poster for my girlfriend's girlfriend. Her little sister was turning 16, and she said, her girlfriend, have Michael draw a poster for Judy's sweet 16 party. And she was like a drill team, had pom-poms. She was real cute, blonde. So I drew a big poster-sized thing of her, like, cheering with her pom-poms, and I put lettering on it. Judy, sweet 16, happy birthday. And her dad was the accountant at NBC. And he goes, whoa, who drew this of my daughter? And she goes, oh, that's Michael Bayouth, Don's friend. And he goes, well, who's Michael Bayouth? Well, he goes to high school with us. And they go, well, we have some summer replacement jobs that are coming up here. Maybe he'd want a job at NBC in the graphic arts department. Boom.
Wow.
2 weeks out of high school, I was working at NBC television, and they also hire the courtroom illustrators from the graphic arts department.
From the graphic arts department at NBC.
NBC.
So if NBC is doing that report of whomever,
right,
at the court, they, right, just say, hey, Mike, go down there and do sketches.
Exactly. I've got all of the drawings, the original drawings that Gene Widoff did of the Manson trial, and this guy is a brilliant, brilliant craftsman.
They
just left these sketches. They're laying around. They were going to throw them away. I saved some of them.
So this is from the NBC files, yes, of whatever,
yeah,
of the Manson trial.
They photographed them and they put them on the news. They edited them into the newspaper, and then they just discard them in graphics. And these were masterpieces to me. I studied them like they were Bibles. I revered this stuff so greatly. He was so great with anatomy. And so I said, I really want to do this.
At that point, you could look at his sketches, courtroom sketches, and say, "Boy, that's great anatomy."
Yeah.
Or great proportion in his figures, or that kind,
yeah,
of thing.
And also architecture. You'd have these drawings that were from like a bird's eye view of the top of the courtroom, where obviously the illustrator wasn't able to get up in the rafters,
mm-hmm,
but yet somehow Gene Widoff knew the architecture and the perspective and everything and all the anatomy,
yes,
so he could
how it would look if I were,
exactly,
that bird's eye view,
right,
in the top corner of the courtroom,
right,
how the lines would go,
yeah,
with how the room would shrink down, and that is amazing. And more amazing, and the wonderful thing I think about life as an artist is, it's funny that you have a tiger in your living room as a kid or whatever, but then you see this perspective of a courtroom and you're going, wow, look at that thing. Look at the lines of that courtroom. It's amazing.
I know. I'm more excited about that
exactly
than the tiger.
Exactly. That's why, your dad hunted tigers, but you're like, look at this anatomy and the Charles Manson. Guys, this sketch artist is amazing.
therein lies the difference between my dad and myself.
Yeah.
And so I got an opportunity to do some courtroom illustration, and it was the very first opportunity was Leslie Van Houten's retrial.
Well, from the Manson
from
family.
From the Manson family. Uh-huh. And Leslie came back out into the trial, and I was sent down there to draw her.
And what kind of thing do you bring with you? A big sketchbook or
something?
It's like
a sketchbook, and then all these markers that are and you do it on vellum, so you can add the color and then kind of move the color around before it dries.
Which is a thicker paper, kind of a paper.
Vellum, exactly. Mm-hmm. You can scratch the black line off if you need to make a correction, and you can move the marker around before it dries, and it kind of looks like watercolor.
Mm-hmm.
But it's real easy to work with, and you can work fast, really fast, which is the name of the game.
Yeah.
Sometimes they'll have an informant come in, ask one question of an informant from prison, and then he's gone, but that's the sketch they want. And you have to take a snapshot with your mind. He's gone and finished the drawing.
Yeah, because you weren't allowed to photograph anything in a courtroom
that's
there.
Why
there was no
there.
Video. No, that's your purpose for, reason for existence right now is that guy who was up there for some 2 minutes, you got to have that accurate sketch of him for the news tonight.
Yeah, so that little snapshot you take with your mind, it has to be what you go from to finish the rest of the drawing. And I got to do trials like Marvin versus Marvin, Lee Marvin versus the whole Palimony thing. I was there.
You were the sketch guy for Lee Marvin?
I was the sketch guy for 13 weeks. Every day I was there.
Are you kidding me?
Trini Lopez testified. Gene Kelly testified. It was like... I drew everybody.
Trini Lopez testified in Lee Marvin's Palimony lawsuit?
Yes. And Michelle Triola, she came up to me, and there's three of us. And
Michelle Triola, who was Lee Marvin's girlfriend.
Yes.
Which at that time, it was, it was out of the ordinary, I suppose. It was a very Hollywood thing for a girl to just live with a guy. And that was the first famous lawsuit where she was with him for so long, and she gets dumped and said, hey, wait a minute, we were kind of married. I think you should pay up.
That's right. That's a very landmark case, and that's why it's been remembered for all these years so well. So there's three artists in the jury box. I'm from NBC. There is Bill Robles, who's from CBS, and another guy.
So everybody has their sketches. Everybody
and we all
from
have
every network.
Our drawings, yeah. And we had no jury. It was just us sitting in the jury box. So it was kind of funny. But Michelle Marvin comes up and she goes, who is the artist from NBC? And I go, that would be me. And she goes, those drawings of me last night were terrible. I had big, saggy jowls. And I go, well, I'm very sorry. I was just drawing him as I see him.
Right.
The next day, I completely cleaned up her jowls. I was a plastic surgeon.
Uh-huh, yeah.
I made her so beautiful. And she came up, she made a specific moment to come up to me and go, those drawings were much, much better last night. And I go, thank you. And she was so proud and walked
really?
Out. Yeah. It looked nothing like her, of course, now.
Right. You just cleaned her up. Let's do some Brigitte Bardot kind of work on her.
But the most memorable thing I think I ever.
Let me ask you, when you're against it, when you guys are three in a row,
yeah.
the network courtroom reporters of this thing, are you cheating off each other?
Oh, big time.
Are you just looking? What's he drawing?
I was doing Art Center classes at night, and my teacher was Bill Robles from CBS.
So you're taking drawing classes from the guy sitting next to you.
Me, and I'm watching, he's got a razor blade, and he's using it to scratch off the line. I go, tomorrow I'm going to bring a razor blade.
Yeah, razor blade.
And he's using this weird smudge style to smudge around the wet magic marker on the vellum. I'm going, yeah, that works really good. So, and he sees me ripping them off. He goes, can't you develop your own style? But we had a blast.
But you were saying about some case that you were involved with.
Oh, my gosh. I can't believe it. I just go to the graphic arts department wearing a T-shirt and jeans, tennis shoes. And my boss comes in. He goes, Michael, we have a New York a team of reporters that is needing you to do a case undercover at the Bistro restaurant in Beverly Hills. I said, what? Yeah, a mob guy came out of hiding after like 35 years, and he's doing business every day now. At the bistro, and they've got a lot of film on him already, but they need a couple of sketches of him doing his business inside the restaurant, and they can't take the cameras inside. I go, well, how am I supposed to go? I'm wearing jeans. He goes, go to wardrobe. They're expecting you right now.
Wait a minute. You were worried about wearing jeans, and they're telling you, listen, go into a restaurant in Beverly Hills, surreptitiously look at a very important mob figure. But be sketching him.
Yeah.
I have nothing to wear. look at me, boss. Maybe I should have something like a scarf. I don't know. Something to set off my neck. Because hadn't they ever heard of photography? Like with one of those lenses or something? Were those spy lenses with the Canon thing?
I guess that, they thought
that would be artsy.
And they said, well, you're going to have to go to wardrobe and be fitted. And they fitted me for, measured me, and I came back 15 minutes later. Went to the art supply and bought a notebook with like a leather bound, cover and just blank pages. So I didn't have like a sketch pad on me, but came back to wardrobe and they had the beautiful 3-piece pinstripe suit fitted for me and fit me like a glove. And I went down to news and they said, we have a brand new Monte Carlo radio for you with a 2-way radio in it.
A Monte Carlo car, brand new Monte Carlo with a two-way radio in it.
We'll be in touch with you the whole time. You're going to meet a bald guy named Ira in the 31 flavors across from the bistro at 1 o'clock.
A bald guy? No, it wasn't a bald guy named Ira.
I kid you not. It was a bald guy named Ira at the 31 flavors. So I'm overdressed in this 31 flavor sitting there.
So drive this Monte Carlo, meet a bald guy named Ira, and he's going to take you to a restaurant where you're going to draw the Mafia Don.
That's right. And I work in the graphic arts department at NBC TV.
So you go. You get in a Monte Carlo that you don't know. It could blow up, Mike. Yeah. You don't know.
Yeah.
You get in the Monte Carlo. You drive.
Mike, are you in the Monte Carlo? Check that news desk. I'm in the Monte Carlo. And you're heading out to see Ira at the 31 Flavors. Copy that.
You were really doing that. I mean, there was a radio.
Back and forth.
So,
He says, we've been following this guy, and we've been getting film of him going to and fro, but we haven't been able to take the film cameras inside the restaurant where he's doing business. That's where you come in, Mike. We want you to draw, get in there, and if we have a good table where you can see him, we want you to draw a couple of pictures of him doing business with these other people. And he's just come out of hiding after 35 years. I go, oh, wow, okay. So they go in there, they check the reservation. He's not there that day. So everything's canceled, and tomorrow, same time, same channel, same 3-piece suit, same Monte Carlo. I'm down there, Ira. And these guys are all wired for sound. We're 300 feet or yards down the street, and he turns around and says, Frank, I'm going to go in and check the reservation again. If anything happens, I'll let you know. The lights go off and on in this van 300 feet down the street. These guys are all wired for sound. And they're just reporters. There's no NBC police that are going to come out of the woodwork and try to save our butts if something goes wrong. They're just trying to, let's go get this story. It'll be great.
So they're playing Woodward and Bernstein. They're playing, basically. We're playing investigative journalists.
Yeah, let's go get a great story.
But if they kill somebody, it'll probably be the artist kid.
It'll just be a graphic artist.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's there. And so they go, all right, let's go. And we go in, we sit down, and I'm about 35, 40 feet away from this guy's table. I can see him.
So you're at a table there, sitting with the stewardess.
Right.
And you're staring across, and you have to draw the mafia guy.
Right. So I just do it real, nonchalantly. I look down at my pad, and I start drawing, and I look up every once in a while, and they're doing business, and everything's pretty hunky-dory. Everything's going along good. I get the first drawing done. The two reporters go, yeah, that's great. Now give me a wide shot of the whole table. And I go, great. And so I start doing the other drawing, and we're ordering lunch, and I'm having a few bites off my wonderful lunch with the mushroom sauce and the chicken. And I'm halfway through the second drawing, and I look up, and this mob guy is looking at me right down the pike. He's looking at me right in the eye. And I go, ho! And I lower my head, and I go, and he goes, what? What? I said, he's looking right at me. And he said, and the guy says, don't look over there. Just have a few bites of your lunch.
Did you? I mean, what? You were holding a pencil. Mike, you were holding a pen. Did you start going, I'm drawing the centerpiece? Oh.
My whole body started to get clammy. I mean,
immediately you drew him in a stewardess outfit. I go, look, it's her. I was just drawing her.
It's a caricature. It's what do you do for a hobby? I'll put you
so
on.
So you're actually you're doing like courtroom reporter kind of sketches of the mafia figure, and you look up for one of those glances that you would do with a sketch, and the guy is drilling you.
Yeah, like I will kill you. And so I just have a.
Did
few
you
more
run
bites.
At that point? I'd throw my pencil.
I just ran and urinated.
And you was like, Ira, Ira, bald Ira, help me! What happened, Mike?
Run, Ira.
Where'd Mike go? I don't know. He was here a minute ago.
Get the Monte Carlo, Ira.
It was just a little poof of dust, a little cloud, and he was gone. So I just took a few bites of my lunch, and about 5 minutes went by, and I looked back over there, and the guy. gets up, pointing at our table, says something to all the people at his table. They all get up. They all exit the restaurant. I go, oh, my God, he's pointing up. He's pointing over here. All the people are getting up and leaving. And so our two reporters get up, and he says, you and the stewardess stay here. If we're not back in 15 minutes, pay for this. And he throws a couple $100 down, and he says, I said, where are you going? He says, I want to try to get an interview with him now that he's seen us. I said, okay. And so we're having small talk with the waitress and I, and and about 10 or 15 minutes later, one of the guys comes back. He's all disheveled. His hair's messed up. He's all sweaty. I said, what happened? He goes, he got very upset. And he goes, did you pay for this? I go, well, I was about to. And he yells, garçon, really loud. About four waiters at the bistro turn around. They all come rushing over. He goes, get me paid for this right now. And he gives us a change right away. And so we're like,
so he was upset. So the guy's like, we got to pay for this. Get out of here.
Get out of here fast, you know. So he pays for it and goes, all right, go back to the network, finish that other drawing, and we'll be in to get them. And I said, okay. So I'm looking in my rearview mirror the whole time I'm driving back to the network. I'm thinking, I'm dead. I'm at some point, I'm going to get, you know, rear-ended or bumped off the road, and these two guys in big suits are going to come over to my window and with a silencer and I'm going to wind up on the news.
But the good part is you stuck around and didn't dine and dash at the bistro.
I did.
You stuck around. I may be killed by a couple of mafia figures, but it would just not be right. It wouldn't be right to leave without paying for my salad that I didn't eat.
I think I did tip something. I left it on the seat, and it wasn't money.
But, oh, my gosh.
Yeah, one of my
the exciting life as a spy artist.
As a spy artist. I mean, they've actually had me draw people that murdered people the night before. These gangs were handcuffed to their chairs. And I'm like, the reporter said, I got you in the clerk's booth so you can be right in front of the killers. I go, really? Do you think in front of them. Right next to the judge? He goes, yes, you're going to be in the clerk's booth. The clerk goes and sits down. I'm drawing in the clerk's booth, and these guys are looking at me. I'm drawing four of them.
They're looking directly at you.
They're handcuffed to the chair.
And it's not like smoke glass or anything. No, it's not, no two-way mirror.
About as far as you and I are away
from each other.
About 3 feet away.
And you're sketching.
And I'm drawing him like this. And he's not listening to his attorneys. He's looking at me going like this, like, I will kill you next.
None of them said, could you put me riding a surfboard or whatever, like a caricature.
He's like thinking, you're my next victim tonight.
So you're sketching these.
Just let me out of these handcuffs and you will be so dead. And so I finish his sketch, you know, I finish it, and the slant board is like this at the clerk's booth, so you can't quite see what I'm doing, you
mm-hmm,
know.
Right.
And I finish the sketch, and I pull it out, and I go to put it on the bottom to go to the next, you know, killer.
To sketch the next guy.
And this guy goes, let me see. He whispers to me. The trial's ongoing.
He's on trial for murder.
Let me see.
I want to see.
And I go, and I'm looking around going, well, is anybody going to stop this? You know, looking at the judge, and the judge is like, he's pending this.
My face is thinner than that.
I pull the sketch back out.
I set
it up on top. I turn my art pad around, and I tip it up for him to see it. And he goes, he cranes his head. He looks back. He's checking it out. It looks like him. He shakes his head.
He nods his head.
He goes, like that. Like
good. Okay. Good job.
And I'm going, great. I can continue now. I've got his blessing on the drawing that's going to be on the 6 o'clock news, which his mother's going to see.
Oh, my gosh.
Because he looked good after 14 hours after he cut this guy's throat.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So just crazy stuff like
that. But when they are chained to a bench with each other, you have time because they're sitting still.
Yeah,
they're not going anywhere.
If they start chasing me, the whole bench has to come with them.
And you could say, hold still, Hector.
And I can bob and weave through the aisles.
Exactly.
All those chairs?
No.
They're never going to bob and weave.
No. My gosh. So being an artist has taken you into what I guess you would have to admit is a very exciting life.
Oh,
I mean, you took the art, and just from the art, you do the Dave Thomas thing.
Yeah,
I think we should tell the Dave Thomas thing.
Sure,
we didn't do that on here.
No, the Dave Thomas thing
because you had a drawing.
You and I were at the Comedy Store in the '80s in Strawberries and Cream, and Anson Down was one of our castmates, and Anson Down contacted me in the mid-80s sometime about he was working with Dave Thomas. And I just emailed a little drawing that I had done of a guy who was strapped in an airline seatbelt that had crash-landed on a war-torn island, and the guy, part of the fuselage and the seat, was connected with him in the jammed seatbelt, and he picks up a machine gun, and he's defending himself and running around with this seat on him, and part of the fuselage was, I guess, was funny to Dave, and Dave hired me as a writer. So I got
on the strength of a drawing.
On the strength of a drawing.
But how do you, like, what... What were you doing that drawing for? You just said it would be fun just to draw a guy and there's a plane crash on an island.
Yeah.
And he's still strapped into his chair.
And Dave.
But somehow he picks up a machine gun.
Right. And Dave created a sketch around it called The Man in 12J, starring Michael Caine. Because you know, Michael Caine does everything.
Michael Caine, right? Is in everything.
So Dave actually had the seat of the fuselage fabricated
to look and like your drawing or something?
Gosh. And he'd like picks up the machine gun. He's opening the window, going firing through the window, and then you know Don Lake, one of the refugees, was in the show, and he comes up. He goes, "I'm getting you out of here." He's saving the refugees on this war torn island, and he goes, "Are you guys hungry?" And he goes, "Yeah, we haven't had anything in days." He goes, "Well, let me see. Hold on." And he presses the button, and there's still like the stewardess on the fuselage. So the stewardess comes up in the middle of the battle. You know, we have the chicken piccata, but we're all out of the block. It was just nuts. So,
So
here I'm a writer on the Dave Thomas Comedy Show. I named the show. I designed the set. I'm one of the writers in the Writers Guild. Mike Myers is one of the writers. Mm-hmm. This is before his Saturday Night Live days.
Yeah.
So we had some of the greatest laughs working with Mike Myers every day. And his insane sense of humor, it was like I had to pinch myself every day. It was so much fun.
You began drawing at the NBC graphic design department. Hey, great! I get to draw pictures of stars and things on that'll be on the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. And the next thing, on the strength of a drawing, you become a writer, you're a performer, but that's kind of how it works, I guess, for people like you who want to work hard and do lots of different things.
Yeah.
Because you never reacted. Like, when they said, hey, would you do this? Or, hey, would you write for Dave Thomas? Or, hey, do you want to do this thing? You never said no. You always were like, well, I'll do even more than that.
Yeah, always.
You never said, but I just draw things.
No, I always say, that sounds like fun.
Yeah.
That sounds like fun. Let's do this.
Yeah. Because you've been working on a movie now, right?
Mm-hmm.
You were storyboarding. Tell me that thing. What's the name of the thing?
The movie is called To Have and to Hold, and it's kind of like a period piece set in the 17th century, romantic novelette gone to the big screen. And I was hired as a storyboard artist, and I was working on The Office as a graphic artist, and I was on a hiatus, so I had worked for a couple of months.
And they just hire you. The production of The Office just hires you for various art jobs they have.
Yeah, it's like whatever the graphics that are needed during The Office, those episodes, I would create the graphics. And then we went on hiatus, and I had to have income over the summer while they were on hiatus. And so I got a storyboard rep called Famous Frames, and they set me up with...
Really? I didn't know. Like, as a storyboard artist...
Yes.
Who does all the planning along with the director, and this is what happens here, and then when our star comes in and the cars chase, and they go off a cliff and everything. But you have an agent yourself.
Oh, yeah. And Famous Frames is known worldwide. They have offices in New York and all over the place, and they rep storyboard artists.
Huh.
And so the very next day after I met with Famous Frames, they set me up with an interview with the producer and the director of this movie. And out of like 12 storyboard artists, they hired me because I knew how to do movie advertising, storyboarding. I knew how to create animatics, which are animated storyboards that give the director even more information about how to shoot the scene. And so they asked me to come to Virginia, and I said they only had 4 weeks approved. And I said, geez, I would love to come to Virginia for 4 weeks, but I've really got to go back on The Office July 9th, and it goes to February of next year, so that's a lot more work. I said, I'd love to be on your movie much more because designing for the office is like the equivalent of designing in Word. It's not too challenging. But I would love to be on your film. And they said, well, why don't you at least come out here for a couple of weeks and work with the director because he's really liked what you've done over the past 2 months. And then we'll fly you back so you can be in the office and start the office. I go, great. So I was out in Virginia 2 days. And in 2 days, they called me into the producer's office and said, Michael, in the 2 days you've been here, you've drawn more than the entire art department has
so
in
what,
2 weeks.
What do you do? I mean, what did you do
then?
Pencils bursting into flames?
I was drawing the sets. I was designing the characters, what the characters' wardrobe would look like. I was defining how key props would look. All these key things that the script called for, I would just start drawing them. And my walls, after two days, were just covered with drawings. And they said, in 2 days, they said, we want you on the production for the rest of the year. And so I had to call the office and say, I'm not coming back. And
so your approach, as it seems to have always been, is I'm just going to do way more than you ask me to do.
Absolutely.
And I'm just going to overstep my bounds and everything. Yeah. And you'll tell me when to stop.
Yeah.
But I'm just going to keep drawing stuff and come up with ideas and say, what if he did this? What if he looked like this?
I was way out of my jurisdiction. I'm drawing sets. The art director does that.
Right.
You know, but the art director was figuring out where the candle was going to go in his office.
Mm-hmm.
Should it go over here? Maybe doesn't look good over there. Maybe I'll get a poster over there, and maybe mm-hmm. Trying to figure out how to furnish his office.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, I was just trying to produce as much stuff as I could in the short time that I knew I was going to be there, and give him more stuff to pick from. And after I finished storyboarding, it was like getting into November, and they said, "Well, can you start designing the movie poster?" Because they knew I did movie poster advertising as well.
Why? Because you told them.
Well, yeah,
of course you did.
They saw my portfolio.
Right.
Said, wow, all these movie posters that you did for BD Fox and Tony Seiniger and Diener Houser Bates and CBS,
the advertising agencies,
Agencies, and they had me designing movie posters. And so, anyway, I was wearing one cap and put on one cap and go to another cap, and all of a sudden now I'm doing movie marketing. And then the film finishes up by the end of the year and goes back to Hollywood. It's in post-production now. And this whole year they've kept me on salary because...
For a year. That started with what?
It started
a little summer job?
May of last year.
Yeah.
I've been on for almost a year and a half now. They had me design and illustrate the whole... all these old 17th century maps for the opening title sequence. And
as you said, this is not for To Heaven to Hold. This is for this another production that they have. Mike, you've done so much. Hey, why don't you look at this other movie we're doing too?
When I was doing the movie poster back in Virginia, it was for the prior movie that they had done.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
And then when I came back out here and they were posting To Heaven to Hold, I started doing the opening title sequence maps, the 17th century maps of Holland. That was completely
done. So you literally do it?
Yeah, literally.
By hand.
By hand with a brush and ink, just like they did maps in those old days, and then on parchment with all, and then they did some wonderful animation where they moved the camera and they animated and created all these wonderful camera movements. And then I did all the actors' names in calligraphy.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't like perfectly computer-generated lettering. It was like hand-done.
For the credit sequence, the camera's literally going across the names or something and around a map?
Yes. So it really gave the movie like this big epic feel. And like a storybook feel almost. And then the production company said, you know what? We need our logo done for our production company. For at the beginning of the movie when they show the animated logo, they needed the logo designed. And so I designed their logo, put on another cap and did their logo design, gave them a bunch of different designs. They picked one. And then in After Effects, I would animate that logo design and rotoscoped some gulls coming in.
Right,
and had
one of those before the movie even starts.
Before the movie, yeah.
Conk, yeah. Whatever.
The lighthouse, spinning around the light.
Yeah,
Imagine Entertainment. So I was going from logo design to animation. I created animatics of my storyboards with dialogue and music and sound effects. All of my storyboards were like moving animatics before the shots were even filmed.
Well, so the great part that I think about your imagination and life as an artist is these years have given you a technical mastery that supports all of these ideas that you get.
Yes.
That if you say, if they say a map, and you could be the guy who raises your hand and says, well, I can get watercolors and get parchment because I know the proper paper that you get, and I could do this with ink and make it look real and everything. Oh, well, we need a logo. Well, I know how to do it on the computer where we can actually animate the first thing, you know, whatever it is.
Exactly.
We need a movie post. So it's just basically, I guess it comes to, of course it's your imagination. Of course it's your work ethic, which is practically unparalleled, but I think it's, you know, the building blocks of just technical mastery that you were doing, I guess, in high school.
It really is. And
just drawing, just straight up drawing. Hey, we need 101 Dalmatians, yeah, and it's a poster for a DVD set and a VHS box, whatever you do.
Right.
And you go like, oh yeah, okay, I could do that. So where
you just start drawing. More mileage you have under your belt as an artist, the better off you are as just having mileage as an artist.
Yeah.
And partway through my Virginia experience on this film, they gave me a part in the movie. I was the Jamestown jailer.
You got a part as an actor?
I got a part as an actor. I got Taft-Hartt lead.
Mike, it stops here. No acting.
I was the Jamestown jailer.
You're doing too much. Don't mess with the spotlight, baby.
I know where they've taken Lady Jocelyn.
Just keep the pencil in your hand, art boy.
just cross the line with you.
You just crossed the line. But no, you've been performing for years. You've actually made the time. You've carved the time out of your busy schedule with whatever you – I mean, I can't even track what you do with the advertising or storyboard art and all kinds of things. But to actually be performing – in a weird Hollywood production of just people doing Christopher Walken impressions, right?
Yes, it's called All About Walken.
All About Walken.
And,
which is one of those hip shows in a little, I don't know, a little, where was the theater?
It was Paul Gleason Theater right on Hollywood Boulevard, uh-huh, near Vine, and it just caught on fire. And this guy, Pat, it was his brainchild, and it just, I don't know, LA Weekly, it caught on fire, LA Weekly and all the different rags
just loved it. It's just people doing various walking things, and it becomes this this hot show.
I wouldn't even tweak some of the stuff. I would just leave it as it is. Like, I opened the show with Nancy Sinatra's These Boots Are Made for Walking. And I just came out and did it as Chris Walken. I didn't tweak the words or the lyrics or anything.
What is...
It's like... You keep saying you got something for me, something you call love, but confess. You know, and people were just like cracking up. And I didn't change anything, or, you know, do the thing from True Romance. You know, you got me in a vendetta kind of mood. Tell the angels in heaven, you've never seen evil so singularly personified as you did in the face of the man who killed you. People would just love to hear it done again, and just like it was in the movie.
Right.
Didn't even have to tweak it. But we did. We did tweak some scenes. And the girls, we had two girls in the show that were fantastic. And just, it was a really, really weird show, and it just caught on. It went to New York and San Francisco and...
So you've had this, you know, a wonderful career, very successful in so many different disciplines. You're such a great artist that I always loved and admired as one of those. We all have that longing, I think, at the part of the arts that we really have to work for because it doesn't come naturally to us. You know, for me, it was visual arts. It was painting and everything. I loved paintings. Your ability to just, it would look like this. Take a pencil. What? Michael, it's the Sistine Chapel. But, well, you know, the ceiling, it bent like that. What? How? What? You know, and I just make I made stick figure. Looks good. But it's been very varied and successful. So, you know, I always ask people, like, what do you recommend for the young person, for the person or the person of any age who desires a life in the arts or who has that ability that you're talking about? Who can draw the squirrel in the back of National Geographic and didn't have to take the test or anything, who just has that ability? Like, what is your recommendation? Or what do you say to young people? Do you teach young people?
I love to teach young people whenever I get the chance. It's a wonderful cathartic moment to be able to pass, give back, and pass along information. My production company, Son of Jason Films, got an opportunity to...
Son of Jason because dad was Jason.
Yeah, because my dad was Jason, so my production company is called Son of Jason. So I got to direct two short half hours for this young actors camp in Azusa. And to watch, to take a kid, like a seven-year-old kid who has no ability whatsoever, and to take his performance from like a zero to like a seven and get it all on camera and yell cut and have all of his friends applaud, it's like to see this kid's self-esteem just shoot through the ceiling was like, you know, it's like a life-changing moment. This is like a big aha moment for this little kid, and you just know that that was a moment in his life where he knows he can do this now. And my advice to kids is whether you're going to be an actor, whether you're going to be an artist, whether you're going to be, it doesn't matter if you're going to be either one of those specific trades, but at some point in your career, you're going to have to get up in front of your boss and ask for a raise. You're going to have to stand up in front of a room full of folks, and you're going to have to represent yourself. If not, you're going to be giving a report, and you're going to be other people or other, you know, there's going to be somebody looking at you, and you're either going to be very uncomfortable and you're going to blow it, or you're going to be comfortable. And having like an acting 101, any kind of a basic acting class under your belt to where you can get up in front of somebody and be yourself and be comfortable in your own skin and present whatever it is, yourself, your document that you're holding, or whatever it is, and do it in a comfortable, you know, very, very... you know, easy way that is obviously that is non-threatening and it's just very casual is going to do you well no matter what you wind up doing as a career. And the other thing is having a little bit of experience with a pencil, even if it's just basic drawing 101. Many jobs in the film industry and in any industry require someone to say, well, I have an idea, then maybe we could do it like this. And if you can't communicate with a quick sketch of your idea, it doesn't have to be great, but even just a quick loose sketch of your idea, you're going to be hampered by trying to ask someone who's non-creative to visualize your idea and how great it could be. And a lot of people don't have that capability. So drawing... and just drawing, basic drawing skills, I highly recommend that you get those. And just basic acting, even if it's a speech class, that's fine.
I think that's
too.
It struck me as odd when you began by saying that, by say the first thing out of Mike's mouth is, I think you should be able to stand up and take an acting class or something like that. And it was like, boy, that's an odd thing. But you know, as you're saying it, it really makes sense, because when you develop, you're absolutely right, when you develop that drawing skill like you did, you went to the set of To Have and To Hold or something, and when you make that great drawing, ultimately you have to show it to somebody, you know, and that is a skill in itself. The drawing is great, but really you have to say, hey, look, I made this drawing. And you have to back it up.
You have to sell it.
You have to sell it. You have to stand there as it, like you unto having to hold. I don't even know if I would do that of saying, well, I drew a lot more things that you didn't ask me to draw. I drew this character and what clothes he might wear. I drew this set. I drew what that might look like. And I just have them all over my walls. Would you like to look at them? I mean, that takes a great deal of confidence.
Because
that's the first thing is I drew something and maybe everyone will hate it.
If I took a whole lot of time drawing any one of those things, it would be to my own detriment. They go, Mike, we're paying you to storyboard and you just wasted 4 hours drawing this, you know, costume. Mm-hmm. Let the costume department do that. But because I can whip out a little drawing of that guy in the costume in about, you know, 3 to 4 minutes, maybe 2 minutes, and stick it up on the wall with a thumbtack and move on to what I'm supposed to be doing, it's now open for conversation. Many people walk through my office and they go, oh, you know what? That's exactly what I thought he would look like. Can I get a Xerox of this and take it over to makeup? Sure, go right ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And now, before you know it, this vision of this guy is now being interpreted down in makeup or down in wardrobe, down the hall, and people are rolling.
Well, it's so nice of you to have me here at your palatial mansion here in the San Fernando Valley. I just, where is the tiger? Did Dad have to, like, give the tiger to the government or something?
He still has the tiger.
He has the tiger.
He still has the tiger.
So he's in an undisclosed location because customs or whatever. There's probably something about having a gigantic tiger.
He had one of those signs made for the fence, the electric fence, beware of tiger, tiger on grounds.
Well, really?
Yes, just so people know that it's not just a dog. There's a tiger in there too. They don't know it's a rug, but he's a character. That's one guy you're going to have to get in front of your microphone.
Yeah, and what? Where can people find you? Are you on? You're online. You have a website.
I'm online. Sonofjason.com is my production company website, and my art website is bayouth.com. That's BAYOUTH.com. And I just finished writing a screenplay with my writing partner Kim. And we have a Facebook page called Facebook/9degrees north. And it's like a coming-of-age piece and set in the 60s against the Vietnam War. And it's really a cool project.
You're drawing, you're working, you're in theater, you're acting, you're screenwriting. Bayouth, knock it off. Thanks a lot, Mike.
Thank you, Tom.
And then Mike's husband, oh, there's this story about Dad with this Friday the 13th director. I'm like, wait a minute. Let me put it back on. What, you have papers here? What are you doing?
My dad did. He goes all over the world to these conventions, these horror conventions.
Oh, he's doing that now?
That's what he
dad
does.
Dad is 86 years old.
He goes.
Dad is not. I mean, he doesn't live in the Taj Mahal, but Dad has probably done relatively well in the industry, hasn't he?
Oh, yeah.
I would only think that at that time, doing those movies, I mean, we modern, contemporary actors now are like, boy, in the old days, they actually made money. But it is true that working as much and consistently as he did, I would think that Dad's not worried about buying that extra Snapple at 7-Eleven on his way home.
There's probably never going to be a time in my dad's life from here on out, or has been for many years, where he'll ever have to worry about money.
So, but he loves going to the conventions.
But what happened was, and it's very similar to you, what happened to you in your career is you became a pop icon. You became, from those movies, you became part of pop culture. My dad made one of those kind of movies that propelled him into the upper ranks of pop culture.
Two differences, Mike. I've never roped a Cape Buffalo, and I've never killed a tiger.
Okay. Well, you had this light, wonderful adventure and had three parts and just, characters that people embraced and loved throughout the world. Well, somehow the Jason Voorhees Friday the 13th franchise has caught on throughout the world and become this thing that's bigger than life itself. Some people have their whole bodies tattooed with my dad's character, Jason Voorhees.
Their bodies tattooed.
Yeah, they come and they take off their shirt and they say, "Look, Ted, I've got you all over my back."
Does Dad travel with business cards of psychotherapists?
No, he doesn't. Okay. But he doesn't need to, actually, because
But I'm only imagining, because knowing your dad, and some girls show, "Look, I've got Jason with a hockey mask tattooed all over my body," and your dad thinking, "Well,
you need some
I'm
help,
very
honey.
Sad for you, young lady."
But he was at a show like 2 weeks ago, and Lou Ferrigno was right next to him.
I know Lou. Yep.
And Lou Ferrigno is going. He has all these people that are crowded around his booth, and he's encroaching on my dad's booth space. And my dad says, "Lou, you get your GD crew and put a line here."
Really?
And they can't. And my dad and Lou Ferrigno got into it. And Lou,
your dad's 86.
Lou wound up moving his booth.
See?
Lou Ferrigno stares down Ted White, and Lou says, "I think I finally moved my booth." "Take your triceps and move."
Yeah, so my dad on the set You know, he didn't know what Friday the 13th was, so this is my story.
Oh, when he was on this, when he got the job.
He asked me to come down to the set one night in Topanga Canyon. I said, oh, my God, I'm coming down. He didn't know that it was this big, it was part four, but he was ashamed to take this job, but he needed the money, and they were keeping him on retainer for a long time, so it was just a paycheck to my dad.
Right.
And he didn't even ask for credit. If you look at the movie, it says Jason, and it says question mark. He was ashamed. He didn't know. So... But so Tom Savini has this incredible head of one of the actors that my dad has to destroy with his massive hand in scene, in a shower scene. So
you mean a fake head that they built that you smash?
That my dad's hand runs through breaks through the shower door and slams this guy's head, this Tom Savini head, up against the marble.
Smashes it. Gosh.
Now, Tom Savini is underneath the head with a big pump full of blood, pumping blood.
He's the special effects guy or something. Because he's built the head.
So, Joe Cito is the director, and I'm just a fly on the wall. I'm hovering everywhere.
Oh, so you're there for the special scene of Dad smashing the guy's head to smithereens.
Joe, the director, has the conversation with my dad. Now, Ted, I want you to really smash this head. I mean, it's got to look great on camera, you know, really. And my dad says, oh, yeah, I'll smash it good. And so now Tom Savini gets him aside and says, now, Tom, I want you to take it easy with this head. We have to go through several takes.
The director says, smash the head to smithereens.
Exactly.
The guy who built the head is like, hey, man, careful with the head.
Careful with the head. My dad, I'll be very careful with it, Tom. So now we get in there. And roll camera. The water from the shower's coming down. My dad runs his hand through the glass, grabs the head, and starts smashing it against the marble. And the blood is being pumped up through the head. Blood is coming everywhere and mixing with the water from the shower. Sure. And my dad's smashing the head. And Tom is going, take it easy, Ted. And my dad's taking it easy. And the teeth are starting to loosen up. And cut. And Joe takes my dad aside. He goes, Ted, I really want you to smash this. You've got to smash this head really hard. I mean, I want to see this thing coming apart. He goes, Tom, Joe, I'll really give it to you. You know, now Tom Savini takes my dad aside and says, Ted, you got to take it easy with this head.
You're smashing my head. We're not going to have a head.
This thing costs thousands and thousands of dollars to create, you know, and all the eyes and the casting and the life casting. It's just like it's taken months to create this head. We have to have at least three or four more takes left out of it. So please take it easy. I'll take it easy with it. I promise. So now they do the scene again, and I'm watching, and I'm just cracking up because I hear both sides of the conversation. And action, and the water's coming down, and Tom's shooting the blood up into the head, and my dad's bashing this
smash
thing
another pane of glass, smash
and,
through.
And the thing is, the hair is starting to come off, and the eyeballs are starting. One eyeball starting to come out, and the nose is lifting up, and cut. And so, how's everything looking? He says, "Well, the director Joe." He says, "It's looking great, Ted, but I tell you, I really this time, I want you to give it everything you've got." And he goes, really? He goes, I want you to smash it. Completely smash it. And he goes, all right, Joe, I'll give you everything I've got. And now Tom Savini takes my dad aside and goes, Ted, you've got to be more careful with this thing. I don't think I can get another shot out of it if you're not careful with it. I mean, everything's loosening up on it. He's trying to smash it back into position. He goes, I'll be careful with it, Tom. So the last shot, they get it back in, they go, and action. My dad runs his hand through the glass. The water is pouring down. The blood is being pumped up into the head by Tom Savini. My dad grabs this thing and literally just smashes the prosthetic head so hard, the jaw drops off. Both eyes just fall out. And now the blood is squirting through the eyes. It is like Tom is screaming, no, my head! And the director's going, Dad, it's fantastic! Dad! Everybody got what they wanted.
Oh, my God.
I'll never forget it. But my dad, he loved playing the part so much that he left the mask on even during lunches and dinners. And he would eat, like, away from the cast. He would take his chair and eat, like, 30, 40 feet away from it. And they go, what is Ted doing over there? Why does he still have the mask on and he's eating, you know?
Do you know how finely you have to chop vegetables to get through the holes in that mask?
Why is he eating with a mask on? I don't know. Leave him alone, though. just don't even go over there. Leave him alone. And so that he just wanted to freak people out. He didn't want to be buddy-buddy, you know?
So he'll still go out there and, what, sign the photos and everything
at
the shows?
Yeah, people bring machetes and they bring the masks.
Autograph my machete.
Autograph my machete, take photographs with him, you know?
And he just loves it.
He just loves it. He makes a great deal of money on these conventions.
My gosh. Well, God bless you, Ted White, out there, you crazy head smasher. Thanks a lot, Mike. I appreciate it, buddy.
I had a great time, man.
Me too. I really enjoyed talking to Mike, and I'm glad, and I hope you did too. I bet you did, because those were some wild stories. Thanks so much. Thanks so much for downloading the podcast. And if you haven't subscribed, consider subscribing. Thanks to Emily Wilson for producing. Thanks to Chris and Katie, everybody over at Nerdist Industries, for all of their help. Thanks to McPherson Guitars for their help with my live show. But as I say, hey, thanks to you. Thanks for dropping by. Consider telling a friend, would you? And we'll talk to you next time. Bye.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.